morning, everyone. Thank you for exercising your free will to bear the cold and come today. Today, we will be considering challenges to free will, and specifically ones that relate to the modern context. Before we get to the challenges from neuroscience and psychology, which might be the most potent, I'd like to consider one that relates to our self-definition. And this actually brings us back to a question that we discussed last week. If you recall, last week we asked the question, how is it that God on occasion seems to sometimes take away the freedom of particular actors, such as Paro, for instance? And we saw that some thinkers, like Rambam, indeed said that that is occasionally the case, while others maintain that freedom is always maintained. And I'd like to consider with you the approach of the Maharal to this question. It could be found in your source books on page 40. And before considering Maharal's solution, let's introduce the matter with a fascinating psychological finding. This is one of those things that you didn't need a study to tell you because we all experience it ourselves. However, studies have found that a remarkable number of people make New Year's resolutions every year, and an equally remarkable number of people fail to keep those New Year's resolutions every year. I know myself sometimes while thinking before Yom Kippur what it is that I want to work on this year, I find myself realizing that that was the same thing that I was planning to do last year. And the resolutions, kabbalos, whatever it is that I made, did not bring me where I was hoping to go. So it's a fascinating thing. Usually, when we fail at something, we quit after a while. The studies show something like 95% or more of resolutions are failed. So imagine that I'm batting 50. So I'll probably quit. And yet, remarkably, people keep on trying again and again. So what is it that keeps them making new resolutions and then so frequently failing to keep those resolutions? So Maharal answers that the answer lies in the fact that people really do want to be good. We really do want to do the things that we resolve to do, whether it's quit smoking or come to davening on time or saying brachos with kavana. So what happens? Frequently we're overtaken by desire, by emotion, by passion. And the Maharal says that this is the basis for tshuva. Many Jewish thinkers have asked, how is it that tshuva is possible? How is it that we could erase the past? Why aren't we responsible for the decisions that we've made? And the answer, Maharal says, is that when a person does tshuva, this of course includes harata and aziva sachet and kabbalah al haba, but when a person does tshuva, essentially what he's saying is, that was not the real me. The real me is the one that wants to do better. In other words, let's take an example that we considered a couple of weeks ago. Somebody goes ahead and sets their alarm to get on to be on time for davening. And then they get up and they press snooze. So who's the real me? The one that set the alarm or the one that pressed snooze? When you set the alarm, you really did want to come on time to davening. When you pressed snooze, so you felt at the time that sleep was something that was more worthwhile. So who is the real me? So tshuva, in essence, is about defining who I really am. I'm really the person that wants to do that which is right. And if it's true and if it's sincere, so that is precisely the reason why a person's past can be erased based off of tshuva. Because essentially what you're saying in tshuva is the real me is the one that wants to do what's right, the one, as it were, that set the alarm. And while it's true that I was also the one that pressed snooze, that doesn't reflect who I really am. I was overtaken by passion, and look at me for who I am and not who I truly am. Now, If that's the case, Maharal says, perhaps we could understand why it is that Paro's ability to repent was taken away. Maharal argues that tshuva is only possible if a person can say, that was not the real me. I'm an intellectual being, a thoughtful, rational person, that's sometimes overtaken by passion, but the real me is the ish sichli. Well, if a person sins using seichel, it's not that their sins are rooted in passion overtaking their seichel, but they actually sin using seichel and through seichel. So then tshuva by definition is impossible. Now that's not to say that they can't change. They can change, but the koach of tshuva to erase the past is not exist. So Maharal argues that Paro, when he sinned, after, remember, the first five plagues, his heart wasn't hardened. What he demonstrated after the first, second, third, fourth, fifth plague, when he still had the freedom and he refused to use it, is that his sins, his recalcitrance, were not just that he was overtaken by desire and passion, but that this was an intellectual decision. He rationally chose evil, as opposed to someone who sins because they're overcome by desire. And as such, so then tshuva is not truly possible. Now, Maharal here addresses a major quandary, which is, who is the real me? The one who desires to do wrong, or the one who longs to do right? And Maharal's answer is that we choose. The agent of choice is what defines who we are. Interestingly, I recently saw in a modern discussion of morality this very same question that the Maharal deals with, and a contemporary philosopher noted a major paradigm shift in contemporary society concerning this issue. If you turn to your source books on page 41, this is an article from Dr. Joshua Noob, who describes this change. The article's entitled, In Search of the True Self. If we look at the philosophical tradition, we find a relatively straightforward answer to this question. The answer, endorsed by numerous different philosophers in different ways, says that the most distinctive and essential to a human being, what is most distinctive and essential to a human being, is the capacity for rational reflection. A person might find herself having various urges, whims, or fleeting emotions, but these are not who she most fundamentally is. If you want to know who she truly is, you would have to look to the moments when she stops to reflect and think about her deepest values. Take the person fighting an addiction to heroin. She might have a continual craving for another fix, but if she gives into this craving, it would be absurd to say that she is thereby being true to herself or expressing the person she really is. On the contrary, she's betraying herself and giving up what she values most. Now, the truth is that the Maharal's position isn't exactly the position that the philosophers are advocating here as well. The Maharal says we could choose who we are, but fundamentally, at least the possibility exists that we are more than our desires, and giving into our desires doesn't reflect who we truly are. Now, Dr. Noob compares this to the attitude that's prevalent in contemporary society. But when I mention this view to people outside the world of philosophy, they often seem stunned that anyone could ever believe it. They are immediately drawn to the very opposite view. The true self, they suggest, lies precisely in our suppressed urges and unacknowledged emotions, while our ability to reflect is just a hindrance that gets in the way of this true self's expression. To find a moment when a person's true self comes out, they think one needs to look at the times when people are so drunk or overcome by passion that they're unable to suppress what is deep within them. This actually relates to the discussion on drug use that we discussed last week, which we won't return to. But there's no doubt that this change has powerful ramifications on some of the most vexing moral issues today. Just for example, one application, which we're not going to get into, but someone struggling with the desires for homosexual relations or the like. So the question is, if they give in to those, are they being true to themselves, which is what the modern perspective would argue, or no, traditionally, one would take the opposite of approach. If a person loses control and gives into that which they don't really want to do, then they're betraying their true self, not expressing their true self. So that's the first issue I wanted to talk to you today about. The second issue, another area in which modernity challenges freedom, relates to neuroscience and developments in science and psychology. Yes?
When you say the morale says you get to choose, is that based on just overall time spent in one zone or whatever over the other? Or it's like when you make a rational choice? Because when you make a rational choice, it's sort of weighted towards one side.
Well, that's his point. His point is that what tshuva is the act of self-definition. Are we going to be our rational? Are we going to live rationally? In other words, who are we? Are we the person that basically an ish sichli that lives by what we rationally wish to do, or are we the person that simply gives into their desires, and lives not by the decisions we make are not governed by that which we intellectually want, but rather what we yearn for and desire.
If you look at a whole year, per se, let's say somebody has a nice full tshuva, but that's still it's 1/12 of the year, which is that, and then the 11/12 year are tacit acceptance of not being.
So the chiddush of tshuva is, and it's true that it's a chiddush even according to the Maral, is that that in Elul, with your heartfelt tshuva, one can in fact erase the decisions of the previous 11 months, because with the claim that they aren't who I truly am. Who I truly am is what I am now. Now again, it has to be sincere, and if it really is sincere, it's unlikely that, you know, the moment Elul ends, it'll entirely go back to the way it was. Okay, so yes.
Why is it that the time they define for something done what they want to do?
What the Maral, I think, is saying is that we are at least fundamentally rational beings and have the capable of living a life and living our life based off of our rational choices. We are capable of being that, but we don't have to be that. So if a person becomes that, then they're not held accountable for the decisions that don't reflect who they truly are. Just like Lahavdil, if somebody becomes so drunk, kishikruso sholot, so they're not held responsible for the decisions that they made while they were in that state, because it didn't reflect who they truly are. So if you could become the ish sechli and live your life that way, so then the decisions you made when you were somebody else, as it were, are not held accountable. Now again, that's a chiddush, and that's the chiddush, that's precisely the chiddush of tshuva. So, good question. Good. So I think that's an excellent point, and that's what I think the Maral is saying, that tshuva it is a transformative process, meaning to say that it's also the other extreme, perhaps the first position depicted in that article, is also wrong. If a person wants to, you know, when he sits down and reflects upon life, he wants to do one thing, but all his actions are something else, so then, in fact, they are not treated as, they're not judged by the person that they wish to be, but they're held accountable for their actions. The Maharal isn't saying that you're not held accountable for your actions. The Maharal is saying that the process of tshuva, by which a person, which as we said is a transformative process and not one which is easy, but if a person can become the person that they want to be, so then they're not held accountable for the acts that they did when they weren't the person they are now. Okay. Yeah.
Just like on the Kaza point, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're adopting the colloquial perspective that's presented in the article, but perhaps that's the best gauge of a person's rational choices. In other words, mm-hmm. when one is in a state of rage, mm-hmm. what degree does their cognitive control, what degree of cognitive control do they have such that that's perhaps the best gauge of who they really are in terms of their control over those basic
mm-hmm.
You would twist it to the opposite.
Right. Good point. Okay. The next point, as we noted in the introduction to this unit, just to quote one neuroscientist cited in an article that I read, his name was Sam Harris, you seem to be an agent acting of your own free will. This cannot be reconciled with what we know of the human brain. And this idea is very widespread among scientists, philosophers, even more maybe in the realm of popular science. And I'd like to perhaps consider what the Torah's perspective would be to respond to these claims that neuroscience has proven that we don't actually have free will, or psychology, or the like. Now, a disclaimer. I'm neither a psychologist, nor a neuroscientist, nor a philosopher, and a complete response is well beyond my area of expertise, should I have any. But at the same time, I think that we can perhaps offer a couple of thoughts. So the first thing we have to do to respond is define some terms. The first term we have to consider is the term determinism. So the most precise formulation for a determinism that I've seen was offered by Peter van Inwagen, and he said that determinism is true if the world is such that its current state is completely determined by A, the laws of physics, and B, past states of the world. Meaning to say, given the laws of physics and past states of the world, then the future is already determined. Essentially, if you knew enough, you could figure out what's going to happen in the future if you know everything that is now, what's been in the past, and how the laws of physics work. Now, accordingly, determinists believe that everything in the universe is already decided. And that's very significant in terms of free choice. For example, when I choose between pea soup and vegetable soup for lunch, so my choice has already basically been made, and the decision is rooted in the conditions that already exist, and really that have existed since the beginning of the universe. Now, as we have seen, that perhaps Rabbeinu Kreskes adopts a similar perspective. And the question is, if determinism is true, do we have free will? Seemingly not. So today, I want to consider three possible responses. The first one, which is, in fact, the dominant view among philosophers and legal theorists, is known as compatibilism. Compatibilism believes that determinism is indeed compatible with free will. We make choices, even though those choices are determined by previous events and influences. And there have been numerous arguments that have been offered to justify this compatibility. Many of them are perhaps similar to some of the approaches that we considered when we discuss the contradiction between foreknowledge and free will. And while I think this approach is promising, many of the variations are complex and highly counterintuitive, and therefore, for the sake of argument today, we're going to presume incompatibility. Meaning to say, we're going to assume, and I don't think that this assumption is necessarily correct, but we're going to assume that if determinism is indeed correct, that is incompatible with free will. So then the question is that if we're going to justify free will, we will have to question determinism. So some thinkers defend free will by pointing out that contemporary physics does not support determinism. Modern physics is predicated upon quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics assume and have demonstrated that the universe is indeterministic. How a particular electron, its trajectory, where it's going to end up, is in fact not determined. Now, others respond that the type of indeterminism implied by quantum physics is not sufficient to justify free will. It may be the case that the trajectory of a particular electron is not predictable. However, generally speaking, phenomena in our universe are highly predictable. Now, to this you could respond that just because they are predictable, that's not a problem because they're not inherently predictable, which means that there is the possibility for freedom. However, again, others will respond that this distinction is not sufficient to reasonably explain the feeling of freedom that we regularly feel. And therefore, I'm going to turn to the third resolution, which is what I think is most promising. And the answer is as follows. Going back to our discussion of the Maharal that we began with, the response to the challenge of free will from neuroscience lies in recognizing who we truly are. If there is more to us than our physical bodies, if there's more to our consciousness than the neurons that make up our brains, so then the notion of free will is no longer scientifically objectionable. To quote one article entitled "Neuroscience Changes Nothing and Everything," philosophers and scientists would agree that if somewhere deep in the brain there are mysterious events that operate independently of the ordinary laws of physics and that are somehow tied to the will of the brain's owner, there will be no problem asserting that there is free will. So why then is it that many thinkers reject this possibility? The answer is that there's no scientific evidence that such a substance exists within the brain. Brain scans performed to date have not discovered anything besides the billions of cells that make up our brain, and therefore many in the scientific community reject this resolution. And with this, I'll explain. I'll elaborate. And I think with this we have possibly an answer. We noted at the beginning that man's free will is not just a result of its higher intellect. After all, angels lack free will despite their superior intelligence. Many thinkers write that the root of our freedom lies in our Tzelem Elokim. Were it not for this spiritual component of our existence, we would be nothing more than the blood, the bones, the sinews, and the cells that make up our body. The central theme of the opening Parshios of Bereshis, the opening Prakim of Bereshis, is that the creation of man differs than that of all the other animals. Man is not just fashioned from the dust of the earth, but God breathes into him a soul, a spiritual component. And it's that spiritual component that is the basis of our freedom. Now, we shouldn't be surprised that that soul does not show up on a CAT scan or a brain scan or an fMRI or whatever it is, because the tools that scientists use to study our brain are not going to pick up a non-physical entity. The soul, the Rambam tells us, is something that is a non-physical existent. It exists. We tend to think of only things that are physical as existing. The soul does exist. It truly exists. But it's not something physical, and it's not going to show up on a brain scan. Now, if that's true, so again, once the problem that scientists have, or some scientists have, with freedom is rooted in their perspective of materialism, meaning to say that there is nothing more to us than our physical bodies. There's nothing more to our consciousness than ourselves. Now, the truth is that even from a scientific perspective, this is questionable. As we mentioned in the first semester, there isn't necessarily a good explanation for the evolution of consciousness. There isn't a necessarily a good explanation, scientific explanation, for how consciousness can be explained simply through materialism. There's a debate whether there's something more to the brain, whether there's the mind and the brain and the like. But even if we can't prove that the soul exists from a scientific perspective, there's also nothing in the scientific perspective that disproves or questions or indicates that the soul doesn't exist. And I think this brings us back to Ramban's central critique of Greek science and philosophy. Scientists err, the Ramban writes, when they presume that the only thing that exists is that which can be seen or detected or empirically proven. The Ramban, writing in Vayikra Perk Tazayin Pasuk Ches, writes, כי היינו צריכים לחסום פי המשחקמים בטבע הנמשכים אחרי היווני אשר הכחיש כל דבר זולסי המורגש לו. Aristotle basically denied all that can't be apprehended by the senses, or we would expand that to say scientific equipment. והגיס דעתו לחשוב הוא ותלמידיו הרשעים כי כל עניין שלא השיג אליו who besvaraso einenu MS. So we reject that notion. We acknowledge the limitedness of our perception. We therefore have no problem with the idea that something non-physical, like God, for example, can exist. Likewise, the soul can exist. Now, to clarify, even if we can't scientifically prove, let's say it like this. Some would respond that this solution that I'm suggesting is silly. After all, from a philosophical perspective, to assume something that exists that doesn't need to exist is as silly as Russell's teapot. And the answer is that I'm not arguing that the soul exists based off of science. I'm arguing that I know that the soul exists because the Torah says it exists. What I'm also saying is that there's nothing in science that says it doesn't exist. It happens to be that when it comes to the existence of the soul, there are many things that can be explained, like consciousness, in a way that happens to be much more compelling than scientists' explanation. But leaving that aside, the reason why it exists, why I know it exists, is because the Torah tells me. And once we acknowledge that the soul exists, then there's nothing scientifically objectionable, I think, to that assumption. And B, that being the case, there's nothing in determinism, or based off of determinism, that would prove objectionable in terms of free will. Because as we said, determinism is based off of the assumption that everything is governed by the laws of the physical universe, this form of determinism. And once we say there's more to the universe than that which we can scientifically perceive, so then I think the basis of the objection goes away. Now, yes?
So you're basically telling me, scientists have said, you know, we've proven that, or we have a model that the brain works a certain way, and we're taking into account the fact that everything is materialistic. So how is it possible that you have any free will? And so you respond, well, okay, that might be true, but, you know, for you, but we have something called the Torah, and even though you can't prove it, and even though you can't ever test it, I'm telling you there's a spirit inside of me. And so I want you to accept that. Is that
I'm not telling anybody to accept anything. I'm telling you... I'm not talking to a scientist. I'm talking to myself. And I'm saying, is there anything in science that has to trouble me about freedom?
You're saying no, as long as it doesn't bother you, as long as you reject.
I'm saying that there's nothing irrational about.
As long as you assume the Torah is true.
Yes. Right. Yeah. That's. I'm coming from a different perspective. Again, one could be more ambitious and try to do more than what I'm doing today, but that's not my goal. Yes.
You can, let's say, harmonize the existence of a neshama, you know, some metaphysical entity that is not perceivable scientifically. Can we really harmonize the fact that you know, the definition of the neshama and its functions, as given by Chazal, really match up with what we perceive in the physical universe? I mean, if, let's say, Chazal is saying neshama has a cheshek and that transforms into physical desire, right? I don't know if that's necessarily scientifically compatible, because we can tell you that your desire was caused by this and this chemical brain.
I don't think that that's an accurate, and maybe another time we could try to expand on this point. I'm not prepared to do so al regalachas, but I wouldn't agree with your assessment of Chazal's understanding of the neshama. Just to
that example was in the
right. No, but that idea. Whether just to give an example, and this goes again back to Maral's point. The Gemara in Sanhedrin writes that after a person dies, so death, the way the Torah views it, is essentially the separation of the body and the soul. As long as we're alive, they're somehow united. That unity is a remarkable thing. As the Torah says, Rofei kol basar mafli lasos, what's mafli lasos? The way in which the soul, which is a spiritual entity, and the body, which is a physical entity, interact, because in many ways they are incompatible. And so after a person dies, the soul separates from the body, and as it were, the soul says to God, I shouldn't be held responsible for that which was done, the sins done on this world, because look, ever since I've separated from the body, I haven't sinned, I've just been floating around and doing nothing wrong. God turns to the body, and the body says, look, don't hold me accountable. Ever since the soul left me, I've been buried 6 feet under. I too haven't done anything wrong. So the Gemara says, imagine the following mashal. A king has an orchard with beautiful fruits, and he puts someone who's lame, unable to walk, and someone who's blind, asks them to watch it. The king comes back a couple hours later, and lo and behold, his beautiful fruits are gone. The king turns to the blind person, and the blind person responds, it can't be me. Look, I'm blind. I couldn't possibly see where the fruits are. He turns to the lame person, and the lame person says, it couldn't be me. I couldn't walk. How could I possibly reach the fruits to eat them? The king then goes ahead and puts the lame person on the shoulders of the blind person and judges them together. So the answer is, it's not the body. It's not the soul. It's the interaction between the two. That's precisely why the Maharal writes that we define who we really are. Maybe we'll go back to this question, because this is actually, I think, the root of the debate between the Rambam and the Ramban about the nature of Olam Haba. Is it necessary that in Olam Haba there be a restoration between body and soul? According to the Rambam, there is no need. Olam Haba is a totally spiritual existence. And the Ramban disagrees, as do Chazal for that matter, and they understand that no, Olam Haba takes place when we have a body. The body is not the same as it is now in our world, but there is more to us than just our souls, and therefore when we experience the eternity of Olam Haba, then we will be a combination of body and soul. So Bezus Hashem, our next unit, which I'm hoping to start next week, is on the topic of Olam Haba. So maybe we'll go back to this question and we'll try to better understand the nature of the interaction between body and soul, and perhaps from that perspective we could also revisit some of the issues we've discussed today. Now, yeah.
How could there be a mitzvah in Olam Haba if there's no way to prove for non-Jews that they should be
well? I'm not sure there's no way to prove to non-Jews their free will. I said that's not what I'm trying to do today. But the almost all societies, certainly including America, are predicated on the notion that there is freedom, and as such there's a criminal justice system, a view of dinim, to which all people are held accountable, and to which all people are held accountable unless you could be shown to be insane, meaning to say not to have true freedom. And it's an interesting question, one which contemporary philosophers and legal theorists are beginning to address, which is, does the science... Is science compatible with the philosophy behind the legal system that exists basically in every civilized country? So it's interesting. The question you're asking is one which scientists and philosophers are beginning to grapple with. But it's my position, though I admittedly have not proven it today, that that the Rambam is right still. And that only a fool would deny freedom, and therefore there I don't think there's anything morally problematic about the mitzvah of dinim, but perhaps a better formulated response is in order.
I don't understand why would that mitzvah be more predicated on free will than any other of the Hashem mitzvahs. And also, even if it's predicated on free will, why is it predicated on the ability to prove free will?
In other words, just to add to that, there's what to say in that, but let's go on. Maybe another time we could talk about that. Yeah.
Clear people who generally, move through the world assuming they have free will. I feel like most people.
So that's another fair point, which is the answer is basically no, and I think that is also a piece of the puzzle. I agree. That is an important point to keep in mind.
Basically, though, people go around what?
His point was that whatever you think philosophically, everybody lives their lives more or less assuming that they have free will. You know, just like, Zeno's paradox, and, people don't go walking into walls. So that's a good point, and also part of the equation. Okay. Another challenge that is sometimes posed to free will based on neuroscience is that it's been demonstrated by certain studies that reactions take place without conscious thought. So there have been experiments that seem to show that, let's say, particular actions like pressing a button are initiated unconsciously at first and entering the realm of consciousness only later. So one experiment had people press a button and look at a clock and note down when they first had the urge to press the button. And using fMRIs, it was shown that there that the decision to press the button in their brain took place before the conscious awareness of that decision. So the question then, which is posed, is if we are making decisions without conscious awareness, then how could we be responsible for those decisions? Now, I'm not entirely sure that experiment would justify that solution, but even if it did, I think it's important to keep in mind the following. First of all, those types of reactions and those experiments, none of them are within the realm of meaningful free will. They relate to things like pressing a button or the like. And the type of freedom that's relevant to us and that we've been talking about is the ability to choose between right and wrong. And I think in this case, in these types of cases, we could still feel confident that the choice is ours, and we in fact have the ability to choose two options, and right and wrong, and sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. Another type of experiment people have pointed to that does in fact relate to moral challenges is that in cases of people that have experienced brain damage or artificially induced brain chemistry changes have resulted in people making different moral judgments. And again, here too, these types of experiments don't pose much of a challenge because an impaired brain not being able to decide normally doesn't relate to how a healthy brain acts, just like the existence of blindness doesn't tell me that sight doesn't exist. Do you have a... So that's why I said, indeed, you're correct. Even the premise of the experiment of the position is flawed, because there might be much more to. We might have freedom that goes beyond our active consciousness. But even if we accept the assumption that we're only held responsible for the decisions that we consciously make and not those that we don't consciously make, nevertheless, those decisions that are relate to those moral choices are as far as we know, still made consciously. I'd like to turn for a moment from neuroscience to psychology. Many people have refuted free will with the argument that our decisions are simply the result of our nature and our nurture. And therefore, it doesn't really make sense to argue that a person has free will. It's a different type of, it's more of a psychological determinism. A weaker form, but still a potent challenge. And here, too, I think that we could respond by turning to the sources that we've considered thus far. As we saw, the Rambam, the Meiri, the Tashbetz, the Ramchal, the Mariyavitz, the Rav Dessler, and so many other Jewish thinkers are not denying the important influence of genes or genetic makeup or environment or the like in our decisions. Even the Rambam, who perhaps offered the most expansive definition of freedom, readily acknowledges the powerful effects that predispositions and environmental factors have on our decision making. And certainly, if we take the approach of Rav Dessler, so then there is still room for meaningful free will. So put differently, Torah sources don't in any way deny the idea that a person doesn't have these inborn reactions or inclinations or the like. It might, in fact, be the case that our unconscious minds are saturated with instincts, biases, habits, emotional responses that silently shape most of our decisions. But nevertheless, there is still a point of conscious making decision, and it's at that point, call it the Nekuda Sabachira, if you will, where we are judged. It's at that point that we feel free. It's at that point that we are free. And except if you're dealing with a person with some type of psychological deficit, like mental illness or the like, so then we struggle with moral decisions, and in fact, we can go both ways.
So, again, if I was a psychologist, I would just come back to that. That's wonderful, but at the moment that you believe that you have free will, and you decide between doing one thing and another because you've entered now the realm of consciousness, those decisions that you are making at the moment are based off of values, which are the result of the nature and the nurture that you currently have.
So the answer is that's not entirely true. That might be largely true, but it hasn't been shown. There's no indication that we
could show. You have to show again. You'd have to default to the Torah perspective, because there's no what they're claiming is that there is a nature component which is completely or rawly physical that is part of you, and a nurture component which is experience. And that's like that. If you're going to boil down the life of a person, that is what the life of a person is. It makes up of this psychological presence, the psyche within his that he experiences and how he operates. And then there's also the physical things that make up his body. There can't be anything else. So
that's the assumption, but there's that's just a statement of assumption that hasn't been proven.
You have examples of people who went against their nature and their nurture, they're raised in a certain environment and their family is a long line.
I could argue that that's just nature. All I'm saying
that's
is
that important. You could stipulate. In other words, you're just making an assumption.
Can you prove to me that invisible space aliens exist? No. Or you can't, like, you hear what I'm saying?
But
you can't prove me wrong. So therefore,
but
I'm right. I mean, you can have.
But you're saying exactly the same thing that I'm. You're saying the exact same thing. You're making an assertion.
All I'm saying is that it sounds to me that if you'd have to default again, which is fine, but I just want to make sure.
I don't think I have to default in this case to anything. I have to. I don't think that there's evidence to that assumption. So then I don't have to respond to it now. Now, the point, though, that I'm making is the following, which is that many times when people claim that the Torah is against psychology, it's because of the assumption that they're sort of reading, let's say, that passage in Hilchos Tshuva and the Rambam superficially, and claiming that free will is predicated on the fact that there is no role to nature and nurture. And that's not the claim. That's not the claim that's being made. The claim that there's no denying that nature and nurture do have a large role in our decision making. The question is that the basis of is that the only basis?
What else would make up your consciousness other than nature and nurture?
Our free choice, our consciousness. That's not a question.
Where does that come from? From what? Where does it
doesn't
exist
have to
from?
Come from anything if it exists.
How do you know it exists?
What does your need to
come from? Okay. I don't think we're going to solve this problem now. One last point, since we're nearly out of time. And that relates to another critique, which is sometimes leveled. The Rambam in Perek Vav, in Perek Vav, raises another objection to free will. The objection is, we alluded to it in previous classes, that how could the Egyptians be punished for persecuting the Jewish people? If you take a look in the bottom of page 41, V'halo kasuv ba'torah v'avadum v'inu osam hare gazar al hamitzriim lasos ra v'ksiv v'kam ha'am hazeh v'zana hare Elohei nechar ha'aretz hare gazar al Yisrael lavod kochavim u'mazalos. So the Lecha Mishnah here notes the following objection, and that is the following. Didn't the Rambam already deal with this in Parakeh? When the Rambam asked the question in Parakeh that there is a contradiction between foreknowledge and free will, and he responded that that contradiction only exists within the realm of human knowledge and foreknowledge and not divine foreknowledge, so he's answered the question. There's no contradiction between the prediction of enslavement and freedom, and therefore responsibility for the Egyptians when they made their choice. So the Lecha Mishnah notes maybe this is just another answer to the same question. The Or Sameach points out that that's a mistake, that this is in fact a different question with a different answer, which is why he puts it in two different chapters. Why is it a different question with a different answer? So the Or Sameach points out that the resolution from Parakeh is insufficient in this case. Why? Because in the Bris Bein HaBesarim, Avraham was told, Ki ger yezaracha be'aretz lo lahem. In Parakeh, the Rambam showed how divine foreknowledge is compatible with free will. However, once a prophecy is given, so it's no longer divine foreknowledge, now it's in the realm of human foreknowledge. And that being the case, so there is incompatibility. Since Avraham knew what was going to happen, Avraham's foreknowledge of the event is incompatible with freedom. Thus, the solution from Parakeh is insufficient, and a new response must be offered. So what is that response? So the answer that the Rambam gives is Lefisha lo gazar al ish ploni hayadua shayiyahu hazona Ella kol echad ve'echad me'osam hazonin lavod kochavim lazalos ilu lo ratza lavod lo haya oved v'lo hodianu abore ella min hago shalolam halam hazeh domeh le'omer ha'am hazeh yeh bahen tzadikim u'rishayim lo mipnei zeh yomar harasha kvar nigzar alav she'yeh rasha mipnei shehodia l'moshe she'yiyu rishayim b'Yisrael ki'inyin she'ne'amar ki lo yechdal avyom mikar v'aretz, etc., etc. Essentially, the Rambam writes that no particular Egyptian had to sin. While slavery was a certainty, each individual's actor remained undetermined and therefore free. The Rashi may actually hold of a similar distinction that the Or Sameach is making. I doubt we'll get to it today. The Ravid objects, as we also mentioned, his basic objection is Al mi chalag ze rascha, meaning to say that once every Egyptian can really go both ways, so how could you say that there's going to be a gzeira? Now, the Rambam might respond that while certain events are predictable on a macro level, individual actors remain free. This is parallels in the physical universe. One is what we just noted, that while electrons might be indeterministic, general movement is true even on an atomic level, not just a quantum level, like with radioactive decay or the like. Each individual atom might last for eons, but the overall rate of decay is very highly predictable. But leaving that aside, I'd like to really turn to the Ravid's solution. That's what I wanted to get to. Just one other point briefly. There might be another response to the question as to why the Rambam asks this question both in chapter 5 and chapter 6 and gives two different answers. And that goes back to a point we made last week, which is in chapter 5, the Rambam's asking an epistemological question. How is foreknowledge compatible with the indeterminism of free will? And he gave a philosophical distinction, namely, It's compatible with respect to divine foreknowledge and incompatible with respect to human foreknowledge. However, in chapter 6, he's asking a different question. It's not epistemological, it's theological. And that question is, how is it that free will can be reconciled with there being a divine plan? In this case, it wasn't just that God left the freedom to the Egyptians. At least it would seem that God had a plan. And if God has a plan, and that plan's going to necessarily happen, that does seem to be irreconcilable with free will, even in light of what he said in chapter 5. It's not just foreknowledge of the event, but rather it's a decree that it was going to happen. Vavadum ve'inu osam. To which the Rambam responds that God's plans exist on a macro level while individual freedom is maintained. And this is similar to the approach that we considered last week with respect with the Rosad Yagon and the like. But as I said, really what I want to focus on, though I won't have a chance to focus on, is the Ravid's response. So we'll briefly present it, and then maybe we'll discuss it a little more next week, though I would like to move on next week. The Ravid, as well as the Ramban, basically respond by saying that the Egyptians did much more than that which was stated in the Bris Bein HaBesarim. In the Bris Bein HaBesarim, there was a prediction of persecution, but certainly not murder, not avodas perach, not kol haben hayilod hayora tashlichuhu, and therefore, because they went much further than that which was actually decreed, so they are held responsible and punished. And moreover, the fact that they didn't do that which it says in the Gzeira, that which was predicted in the Bris Bein HaBesarim, shows that they weren't acting l'shem shamayim. Rather, they were acting for their own interests. If their kavana in persecuting the Jews was l'kayim es ha-nevuah, so then they would have done what it says in the nevuah. From the fact that they went ahead and killed and went much further, so what that shows is that they were choosing to do evil, and their intentions were evil and malicious, and as such, they're held responsible for their choices. Now, the question that we have to consider is the following. One is more technical, which is there any reason to assume that the Egyptians knew of the Bris Bein HaBesarim? Maybe we could say that even if they did, the point is that they would still be held responsible because they went further and their intentions were malicious. So what I want to instead consider, and again, I guess I'll leave you with a question, something to think about over the week, and that is the following. The Ramban and the Ravid both assume that if the Egyptians hadn't gone overboard, then their enslavement of the Jews, Bavadum Inu Osam, would have been justified. Ramban says it would have even been a mitzvah. And the question is, but there was no tzivoy. Enslavement, persecution is, generally speaking, immoral. And it's one thing to say that if God commands you to do something, then you should do it, even if it seems immoral. But there was no commandment. The Egyptians were not instructed to enslave the Jewish people. Avram Avinu was told that it would happen, but there was no tzivoy. What would seem to be the response is that the Ramban is assuming that if a person is mechaven to do Ratzon Hashem, then it's a mitzvah, even if the act would otherwise be something that's highly immoral. And the question is that true? And what are the ramifications of that? Is every act done l'shem shemayim, even when otherwise immoral, a mitzvah? So the answer, of course, is that here there was a nevuah. But the question is, how do we figure out the parameters of that very important question? So, Be'ezras Hashem, We'll begin with that next time, and we'll also start the next sugya as well. Have a good Shabbos.